This evening we are to have an address which is entitled Mindfulness, a Spiritual Perspective, and that is to shortly be given by Brother Alan Wharton. Alan has asked for a very short introductory reading taken from Luke chapter 10, reading from verse 38 to verse 42, which is the end of the chapter. So that's Luke chapter 10, reading from verse 38. Now it happened as they went that he entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she approached him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Therefore tell her to help me." And Jesus answered and said to her, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things, but one thing is needed, and Mary has chosen that good part, which will not be taken away from her." So with that introductory reading, I now invite Brother Alan to speak to us on mindfulness, a scriptural principle.
Well, brethren and sisters, good evening. I don't know what the compilers of the Bible class program had in mind when they included this subject in the syllabus, whether it was a request from someone in the audience or some other reason. And at first glance, some of you may wonder what mindfulness is, or perhaps what it can offer to us. Mindfulness is not a word found in the Bible. And as we shall see, the term as it is used today has only a tenuous link with our philosophy of life in the truth. But therein may lie the reason or a justification for spending an evening on the subject. I suspect that some of you may believe that this is just another jargony term, which is here today, will be gone tomorrow, some passing fashion. And therein may lie another reason for spending just a little time considering it. Because we tend, I think, to view the world from a narrow perspective. And yet this is the world to whom we should be a witness to the love and peace of God's truth. We should be lights shining in a dark place. We should be inwardly and outwardly giving evidence of change. People should be able to see something different about us compared to the majority of people around them. And the impact which many people seek to achieve through the process of mindfulness, which we'll define in a minute, should ideally be a byproduct of the belief that we have in our God. Ideally. But few of us reach the ideal state. So then, what is mindfulness? Here's a definition from Wikipedia. Mindfulness is the psychological process of bringing one's attention to experiences occurring in the present moment. If you can get your head around that one. Bringing one's attention to experiences occurring in the present moment, which one can develop through the practice of meditation and through other training. And he goes on to explain that the term corresponds to an element of Buddhist tradition, but don't be put off by that at the moment. Another definition comes from a website of a private health insurer. Mindfulness is a mental state achieved by focusing one's awareness on the present moment, while calmly acknowledging and accepting one's feelings, thoughts, and bodily sensations used as a therapeutic technique. I thought it would be a good idea if I got some further information about this, and I got a book from the library published about 5 or 6 years ago, and the writer explains mindfulness living has two components. You learn to be mindful in everyday life, increasing your enjoyment in life and handling difficulties which can be brought into play at any point in the day. The other component of mindfulness is meditation, which is done in a more formal way by making a commitment and setting aside time for it on a frequent and regular basis. Meditation is, in fact, the key skill for mindfulness, and it is meditation practice that creates the ability to bring mindfulness into everyday life. In the same book, the writer draws our attention to the difference between being and doing. In contrast to a newborn baby, which spends its days apparently doing nothing and just being, its parents are usually busy with the opposite. They are doing non-stop, just to enable the baby to be. For most of us, as soon as we stop being babies and children, we continue with too much doing and not enough being. Stress builds up when we neglect to allow enough time for being, not understanding what being should mean. Sometimes it is stressful just taking the time to stop doing because we are conscious of the continued pressure in our lives. So we can find ourselves on a treadmill of real or ingrained activity, not necessarily of any particular need. We can delude ourselves even that we are busy when we are not so busy, when we think we are doing, but we are not really doing anything. And so meditation and mindfulness is a way of redressing the imbalance between being and doing. Now, as most of you know, life in our society, particularly in our Western society, is stressful. There are all sorts of reasons for this, some external to ourselves, but much of it resulting from the way we live our lives. Stress actually costs money, something which drives much of our own society, because people who are stressed are inefficient, and it's the personal impact of stress that can destroy people's ability to function. And that's the reason why businesses and organisations now include mindfulness in its armoury of training resources. It's the reason why the NHS provides information about mindfulness, because it can be much more effective and significantly less costly than putting people on drugs or sending people for therapy or dealing with the damaging results of people who manifest stress in harmful or even violent ways. So, for example, the two organisations, public sector organisations I work for, have produced details of resources, training resources, well-being resources to help us deal with stress. That's one of them, looking after yourself. All sorts of opportunities, courses designed to help people look after themselves better so that they are calmer and more efficient and better people to do the job. And it includes everything from taking notice of how colleagues are feeling or acting, spending time outdoors, and in this particular case, amongst a dozen or so particular opportunities is mindful space. That's one. The other organisation I work for offers a six-week mindfulness course. And it says, mindfulness is a natural present moment awareness that enables us to see situations more clearly and make better choices about how to respond to challenges in creative and effective ways. In the workplace, mindfulness training provides practical skills to manage stress, improve well-being, make better decisions, and communicate more effectively with greater emotional intelligence. In today's world of constant distractions, mindfulness enables us to take more control over how we allocate our attention and energy so we can lead more satisfying lives both at home and at work. That's just an illustration in my particular working life of how important this is seen to be. The key concept of mindfulness is the idea that only the present moment is real. Only the present moment. The past only exists in the memory. The future only exists in the imagination. The essential technique of mindfulness is to bring one's self completely into the present moment in time, and to completely engage in it. Constantly thinking about the past, which can't be changed, or about the future, which can't be predicted, can be very unhealthy. Mindfulness training usually begins with an exercise to focus on the immediate moment. And maybe some of you have heard of the Raisin test. It's by really thinking about something you have been given to eat. Its shape, its flavour, its natural beauty. Or possibly to think about how your body is feeling, where the areas of tension are, how you're breathing, where pain exists, and how this can help you gain calm. Mindfulness needs practice. The guidance says it should be practiced every day for 30 or 45 minutes, in which one learns to detach oneself from everything else and to accept the present. It's not the same as resignation, because that implies that nothing can be done to address a problematical situation. Positive thoughts are also associated with mindfulness, such as happiness and kindness, things that need to be developed. But it also has to be acknowledged that practicing mindfulness can have harmful effects as well. And that's because the mind is full of memories, which can be painful or distressing. And mindfulness can release memories which have been forgotten or pushed deliberately to the back of the mind. Meditation exercises, which are designed to release mental and even physical energy, can be the wrong response to situations that require calmness. The process heightens awareness rather than reduces it, so it's not the same as relaxation. And that's why books and guidance on the subject recommend that people who want to explore mindfulness or meditation take advice before they do so. And they take a course which is adapted to their needs. So where did the idea come from? In the earlier quote, we found that the term mindfulness corresponds to something which was a significant element of Buddhist tradition. This religion has its roots in ancient India from about 1000 BC, although more recognisable a bit later than that, about 400 BC. And the religion believes that human beings expect happiness from things which are impermanent, transient. And it was a response to the tragedy of suffering, which is common to mankind. Suffering being illness, old age, and death. And the fact that there is a never-ending cycle beginning afresh with each new birth. A new birth which is then followed by illness, old age, and eventually death. A tradition says that the first Buddha who broke away from the Hindu religion, seeking new answers to the problem of suffering, spent a night in meditation near a Hindu temple. And at daybreak he saw a vision when the meaning of all things unfolded. And he attained what is described as nirvana, which is freedom from suffering, and something that actually cannot be described in words. And apparently the revelation was so startling that the Buddha decided he could not then distract himself by trying to answer other questions about, for example, whether or why God exists, why or how the world was created, because he believed that the answers to such questions would not help relieve the suffering of mankind, which was the reason for his meditation. I'm just going to spend a little while, just a minute or so, talking about the way this concept, this religion really, is built up, because it is the foundation of what much of mindfulness is based on, and then of course we'll look at this further from the scriptural point of view. So the Buddha's main teaching is made up of three universal truths, four noble truths, and the Eightfold Path. And these are made up as follows. The three universal truths. Firstly, everything in life is impermanent and is constantly changing. Secondly, impermanence leads to suffering, because it's constantly changing. And thirdly, there is no unchanging personal self. I'm not going to spend any more time talking about those. But moving on to the four noble truths. Firstly, all life involves suffering. Secondly, the cause of suffering is desire and attachment. Thirdly, desire and attachment can be overcome. And fourthly, the way to overcome them is to follow the Eightfold Path. So now the Eightfold Path, and this is where it perhaps becomes a little bit more understandable. The Eightfold Path is a right viewpoint, right intention, right speech, right action, right work, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Well, today, Buddhism is the fourth largest religion in the world, and it accounts for 7% of the world's population, mainly in India and Asia, but many other parts of the world as well. What caused these principles of Buddhism, just outlined, to jump into mainstream Western thinking and to become such a major contributor to the quest for answers to the problems people face in their lives today through the technique of mindfulness? The world today is full of different religions. It's also full of people who have no religion, who have no particular faith. And the most enlightened countries allow complete freedom of religious belief, or are also willingly able to accept the absence of religious belief. Mindfulness has borrowed the techniques of the Buddhist religion and filtered out the religious element. It does seem, however, that there is less recognition in the Buddhist religion of a deity and more acknowledgement of human ability to reason out the answers, basically to this problem of suffering. Some of the philosophy makes sense, particularly that Eightfold Path. But there are fundamental flaws, so far as we are concerned, such as the stance that questions regarding the existence of God or why and how the world was created do not help relieve the suffering of mankind. We have, in the truth, a very clear conception of the place of suffering in human experience, something that's very different from Buddhism. We have, as I said, no particular issue with most of the Eightfold Path, which has some similarities with the principles behind the Ten Commandments. Now let's think about the historical content. About the time that Buddhism developed in India, about 2,500 years ago, Jerusalem was about to fall to the Babylonians, and more Jews would be carried into exile. The northern kingdom of Israel had already collapsed some 150 years or so before, and the root cause of the exile was the idolatry and disobedience of the children of Israel and their ignorance of God's ways and his teaching. And with that, spiritual darkness descended on the earth, with only a handful of faithful Jews in captivity or elsewhere until a limited restoration. That was the time, as I say, when Buddhism was developing in India, and similar things were happening in China as well. If we go further back, the ideas that developed into Buddhism were beginning to form at about the time of Saul, David, and Solomon. Solomon was the author of what are known as the Wisdom Books, which contain so much observation and analysis of the human state. It's interesting to compare the levels of enlightenment or darkness in existence in the world at these stages in history. Was the mind of mankind developing at roughly the same pace in different parts of the world, more or less simultaneously? And was God providing an injection of wisdom and insight into the minds of his people through men like Solomon, so that they could gradually counter the development of human philosophies in the world in which they lived? But what's even more startling is the knowledge and conviction we have that the God in heaven has revealed the truth to mankind from the very beginning. And for this reason, men like Noah and Abraham and Moses were extraordinarily advanced in comparison to their contemporaries. And no wonder that people from other parts of the world came to people like Solomon, as the Queen of Sheba did, to quiz him on his wisdom. Where did he get it from? The truth is that following the fall in the Garden of Eden, sin's nature has been the common inheritance of all mankind. And along with it came the curse. The curse brought with it physical imperfection, disease, suffering, the struggle to exist, stress, and evil human characteristics of every kind, to say nothing of the curse on the earth itself. And the only place that was immune from all of this was heaven, the dwelling place of God. And the Bible tells us that there is a reason for this suffering. So the idea of the noble truths that the cause of suffering is desire and attachment and so on seems very far-fetched when viewed from a spiritual and scriptural perspective. We know that God has put in place a repair strategy to deal with suffering and its root cause, to cleanse the world from sin and to offer salvation to mankind without exception. The world will not continue in its imperfect state forever. The first principles of this unite us in our fellowship with God, the Creator, and with each other. And God's revelation is so very different from the human philosophy that we've outlined. So now perhaps we should turn to a few passages which speak to us on this vital topic. Passages that could be multiplied because God has given us so much in his word to put these things in their right place. I'd like to go through these quite quickly. I've got Isaiah chapter 66, verse 1 to 4. Isaiah chapter 66, verse 1. Thus saith the Lord, the heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that ye build unto me, and where is the place of my rest? For all those things have mine hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Lord. But to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word. He that killeth an ox is as if he slew a man. He that sacrificeth a lamb, as if he cut off a dog's neck. He that offereth an oblation, as if he offered swine's blood. He that burneth incense, as if he blessed an idol. Yea, they have chosen their own ways, and their soul delighteth in their abominations. I also will choose their delusions, and will bring their fears upon them. Because when I called, none did answer. When I spake, they did not hear. But they did evil before mine eyes, and chose that in which I delighted not. And I think that fourth verse there is very appropriate to our consideration this evening. It requires us to acknowledge God, the reason why we are in the imperfect state, what we need to do to relate ourselves with God the Creator. Now go back to Psalms, Psalm 46. Psalm 46, verse 10. Here is a description, really, of what mindfulness seeks to achieve. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. I think it speaks for itself. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. Hebrews 11, verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. And Hebrews 13, verse 5. Let your conversation or your way of life be without covetousness. Be content with such things as ye have, for he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. So the first part of that verse corresponds actually to much of the eightfold path. And the assurance that mindfulness seeks to give us is in the second part. I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Meditation. There are quite a few mentions of meditation in the Bible, but none of them seem to equate to the type of meditation associated with mindfulness. Mindfulness meditation, in its purest state, as practiced by the Buddhists, has no specific focus. It dwells entirely on the moment and the nature of reality, with the goal of demolishing the illusion. And I suppose that's why it's so difficult to do, why it needs so much practice. And there's nothing like that in the Bible. Every instance of the word meditate in the Bible suggests deep thought on something very specific. A complaint, a puzzle, a dilemma, all about God himself. So the Bible leads us to the view that a person seeking to know God's ways should focus their minds on something very specific, and at its heart to look at God as the source of every answer. What are more helpful, I think, are the many references in the scriptures to peace. And a mind at peace is surely one of the key aims of mindfulness, often pursued through meditation. But scriptural peace is achieved in a very different way and for a different purpose. Unlike meditation, we found plenty of passages which have a great deal of bearing on this topic when we think about peace. The advice and the commandments given to the children of Israel, God's own people, sum this up. And what was said to them as a nation is simply an extension of the way that God has instructed individuals, both before and after the law of Moses was given to the nation of Israel. Just have a look at this key passage in Numbers chapter 6, a passage which we're all very familiar with, but perhaps wonder why these verses are found in the context that we do find them in. But that aside, just consider the amazing verses that these are in the middle of the law of Moses. Numbers chapter 6, verse 22. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, saying, On this wise ye shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. And they shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. That is much more value than the human approach in mindfulness. The children of Israel had been redeemed from the hard bondage and the suffering of Egypt. Egypt was symbolic of a place and a condition to be feared. It was full of idolatry and superstition, full of pride and greed. It was not a place where any child of God would choose to go or to be. God's declaration spoke of a very different place to be, a place to which he would take them. At its heart was the intention to suppress the root cause of suffering, which is sin. And Egypt is symbolic of sin. In several places, we read about a covenant of peace as a solution to this problem. And a covenant of peace implies two sides to an agreement. On the one side was God, and on the other side were people, both as individuals and as a collective. So as we're in Numbers, turn across to chapter 25 and read verse 10. Numbers 25. Verse 10. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, hath turned my wrath away from the children of Israel, while he was zealous for my sake among them, that I consumed not the children of Israel in my jealousy. Wherefore say, Behold, I give unto him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made an atonement for the children of Israel. Now turn over to Ezekiel chapter 34. Ezekiel chapter 34, verse 23. These passages, by the way, are almost taken at random because there are so many that we could quote, and all of them have a bearing on this subject in some way or other. Ezekiel 34, verse 23. I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David. He shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd. And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken it. And I will make with them a covenant of peace, and will cause the evil beast to cease out of the land. And they shall dwell safely in the wilderness, and sleep in the woods. Chapter 37 and verse 24. David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. And they shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob my servant, wherein your fathers have dwelt. And they shall dwell therein, even they and their children and their children's children for ever. And my servant David shall be their prince for ever. Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will place them and multiply them and will set my sanctuary in the midst of them for evermore. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Yea, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Having looked at these principles then, how do things like mindfulness and meditation play out in the lives of real people? And again, the Bible provides us with plenty of material to consider. We can't go into details, and you will know all of these examples. Such is our familiarity with God's word. And we'll be able to relate them to the human approach to mindfulness and meditation, which we have outlined. So without too much thought, we can quickly assemble a list of people who we know spent time alone, meditating, wrestling with their human problems, with their fears and their doubts. Some of them were deliberately taken into solitude in the wisdom of God to enable their minds to be freed from the clutter and influence of human society, so that they were ready to re-engage with God from a new perspective. Very quickly, just a list of them. Job was taken away from his comfortable and his prosperous lifestyle, stripped of all that made life worth living, made to endure the false reasoning of so-called wise men, until he was brought to the realization that he could not save himself. He had no personal answer to his suffering, or justify himself before God. But God gave him eventually peace when his mind was in the right place. Moses was sent into a wilderness place after he had disgraced himself in Egypt, and he was prepared by God for his service. Joshua had a busy and responsible role, but he never forgot who he was really serving and where the source of his success came from. Jonah was another man who had very definite views on who should be saved and who shouldn't. God gave him time, which he sought to resist, and enabled him to reach the right conclusions. Shut up inside the fish, he had time to meditate. Underneath the gourd, he had time to see things from God's perspective. David spent his youthful years in the wilderness tending the sheep. The youngest of the worldly wise brothers, he was one who God chose to be king over his people. And the results of his mindfulness training are revealed to us in the Psalms, passages which later supported the Son of God himself as he offered the greatest sacrifice ever. Solomon had the opportunity to consider the vanity of human existence, noting how ultimately we are all the same, whether rich or poor, whatever our circumstances, when it comes to our status before God. There are fewer recorded instances in the New Testament, but the obvious one is Paul, who after his conversion and his baptism was sent away into the desert of Arabia for 3 years, as Galatians tells us, to retrain his mind and prepare him to become the apostle to the Gentiles, and a background which enabled him to endure all those sufferings which are listed in his writings. But above all, we have the example of Jesus, who was tempted in all points as we are, but crucially without sin. He spent 40 days and nights in the wilderness, coming to terms with temptation, and he needed that space and experience before he began his ministry. So, what about mindfulness in the truth today? This evening we have looked at mindfulness, what it is, along with meditation, and how this is a growing technique to help people cope with life in the world. We've considered its origins, or at least the origin of the words used in this context, emphasised the philosophy that lies behind it, and noting some of the stark differences with our understanding of human needs, the existence and origin of sin, and God's plan. We spent a little time thinking about peace as found in the Bible, as that would seem to equate more closely with mindfulness and meditation than the biblical examples of meditation. Taking the way mindfulness is and meditation is practiced today, we have listed a number of familiar people from the Bible who went through experiences of mindfulness and to some extent of meditation, and how the outcome was very different from that expected from following the practice today. So are we then to dismiss mindfulness as something from which we can learn nothing, or which we should completely dismiss? I think that would be a step too far. There are times in the truth when, for example, we are so preoccupied with all the things that we need to do that we don't give ourselves a chance to dwell on the wonder of the truth itself, or the long-term futility of human effort, or of our own need to absorb the essence of what we believe and put our faith in. We can get stressed by the business of the ecclesias, the meetings, rushing hither and thither with all the activities that go on, the things that we feel need to be sustained, the many and varied things that have to be done. If we have reduced the truth to this and this only, then we are no different from anyone else or their religion, because we have lost the ability to think about the truth itself. We are focused on doing and not being. And if we are in that place, then mindfulness in a scriptural sense is something we need. We also need meditation, when we give our brains a chance to put the doing aside for a while and dwell on the reality of what it is all about. So I'd like to conclude by just reading to you a very short article that appeared in a Christadelphian magazine entitled Mindfulness. Mindfulness is paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. Regardless of which exercise or task you are doing, it is about bringing awareness to thoughts and actions. Mindfulness teaches how to quiet your mind to enable you to be in a state of being rather than doing. It is about practicing love and compassion, both to self and to others. Even though contemporary mindfulness is often rooted in Buddhism, Christians can use it helpfully. As frail human beings, we are as susceptible to external pressures or mental health problems as the next person. Faith may anchor our hope for the future, but our daily struggles may threaten to overwhelm us. Mindfulness can help in managing an individual's health problems and also in worship and awareness of God. Mindfulness allows you to connect more deeply to God. We can use it to turn down the noise in our heads, allowing us to focus our minds on Christ more effectively. For example, practicing mindfulness at the meeting means being present in the moment, listening, feeling, and experiencing, rather than being on autopilot or planning the rest of the day's tasks and chores. A practical example of the need for mindfulness would be Mary and Martha. That's why we quoted from the record about them at the beginning. We can all be Marys and Marthas, torn between listening, being, and doing. Jesus does not say that Martha's actions were wrong, and yet he does remind her, and all of us, that listening must come first. Mindfulness constantly teaches this. Because God is part of our everyday lives, paying attention to God and focusing on God's kingdom is a fundamental part of Christian mindfulness. You cannot pay attention to the present if you're worried about the future. Do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? Said Jesus. Mindfulness allows you time to look at yourself at any given moment with compassion, to accept what is, and to know that God is in control.